Welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, September 15th, 2022. I'm glad to be your reader today. My name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. Looking at the front page of the paper, there are three stories. The first is about community help for those who are hungry. Beneath that, an update on the rail union strike potential, and a third one that has to do with orthopedic surgery. We'll start with the top story that's titled, Willing to Help, First Interstate Bank Volunteers at the Lord's Cupboard. This is by Kelby Wingert. First Interstate Bank's Fort Dodge branches closed early on Wednesday for a very special bank holiday, First Interstate Bank's fifth annual Volunteer Day. Though the bank's presence in Fort Dodge is recent, FIB merged with Great Western Bank earlier this year, its commitment to community involvement runs deep, according to First Interstate Bank Fort Dodge President Mike Larson. It's truly a community bank, Larson said. Without the communities we serve, we wouldn't be around today, so this is something we believe in strongly. The bank's more than 300 branches across 14 states closed at noon on Wednesday so that their employees could volunteer through various service projects in their communities. In Fort Dodge, 16 First Interstate Bank employees spent part of the afternoon packing food boxes, stocking shelves, and unloading food deliveries at the Lord's Cupboard Food Pantry. The Lord's Cupboard is located at 127 North 10th Street, just three blocks northeast of the bank's downtown branch at 825 Central Avenue. We see firsthand the need and the benefit that they provide, Larson said. Leading up to Wednesday's Volunteer Day, Fort Dodge's First Interstate Bank locations held a canned food drive to collect items to donate to the Lord's Cupboard as well. Larson said both bank customers and employees brought items and cash to donate. The bank employees delivered a truck full of food and presented a check for $500 to the pantry. Melanie Furkey, director of the Lord's Cupboard, said the community food pantry would not exist if it weren't for volunteers like the group from First Interstate Bank. We exist with two part-time staff and 30 to 40 volunteers a week, Furkey said. So I couldn't do it without the volunteers. About 99% of the work that goes into keeping the food pantry running smoothly is done by volunteers, she said. Without them, we wouldn't be able to get the food unloaded from deliveries, put on the shelves, packed up, and given to the clients, Furkey said. As the increased supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits expired with the wind down of the COVID-19 pandemic, communities across the state are seeing more and more families need to use the services of their local community food pantries, Furkey said. During the pandemic, the Lord's Cupboard would serve about 500 individuals each month, she said. Last month, 1,300 individuals were served. After spending time at the Lord's Cupboard, the First Interstate Bank group continued its volunteering with a service project cleaning up the downtown area ahead of Saturday's Downtown Country Jam concert. This story is accompanied by several photographs. One of the First Interstate Bank people rolling in a cart of food to restock shelves, others working to load up carts to restock shelves. They're good photographs. And the top one is of Tammy Wegener, who is a teller at First Interstate, restocking shelves as well with a big carton of canned tomatoes. Next, the story about the perhaps impending rail strike. One rail union rejects deal, two accept ahead of strike deadline. This is from the AP in Omaha, Nebraska. Members of one union rejected a tentative deal with the largest U.S. freight railroads Wednesday, while two ratified agreements and three others remained at the bargaining table just days ahead of a strike deadline, threatening to intensify snarls in the nation's supply chain that have contributed to rising prices. About 4,900 members of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, District 19, voted to reject the tentative agreement negotiated by IAM leaders with the railroads, the union said Wednesday. But the IAM agreed to delay any strike by its members until September 29th to allow more time for negotiations and to allow other unions to vote. Railroads are trying to reach an agreement with all their other unions to avert a strike before Friday's deadline. The unions aren't allowed to strike before Friday under the federal law that governs railroad contract talks, which include BNSF, Union Pacific, Norfolk Southern, CSX, Kansas City Southern, and the U.S. operations of Canadian National. Government officials and a variety of businesses are bracing for the possibility of a nationwide rail strike that would paralyze shipments of everything from crude and clothing to cars, a potential calamity for businesses that have struggled for more than 2 years due to COVID-19-related supply chain breakdowns. There are 12 unions, one with two separate divisions representing 115,000 workers, that must agree to the tentative deals and then have members vote on whether to approve them. So far, nine had agreed to tentative deals, and three others are still at the negotiating table. Of the nine that agreed to the deals, two, the Transportation Communications Union and the Brotherhood of Railway Carmen Unions, voted to ratify their contracts Wednesday. But IAM members voted to reject their deal. Votes by the other six unions that approve tentative deals are pending. All the tentative deals are based closely on the recommendations of a presidential emergency board Joe Biden appointed this summer that called for 24% raises and $5,000 in bonuses in a five-year deal that's retroactive to 2020. Those recommendations also include one additional paid leave day a year and higher health insurance costs. The key unions that represent the conductors and engineers who drive trains are holding out in the hope that railroads will agree to go beyond those recommendations and address some of their concerns about unpredictable schedules and strict attendance policies that they say make it difficult to take any time off. They say the job cuts major railroads have made over the past 6 years, eliminating nearly one-third of their workers, have made a difficult job even harder, although the railroads maintain their operations have just become more efficient as they rely on fewer, longer trains. The unions want the railroads to provide unpaid leave time that workers could use to attend doctor's appointments or attend to other personal business without being penalized. Ron Kamenkov, General Secretary of the Railroad Workers Union United Labor Group that includes workers from all the rail unions, said he left the freight industry for an Amtrak engineer job in Nevada years ago because of the grueling working conditions that have only gotten worse in recent years. He's seen many other workers make that switch, even though it often comes with lower pay and means giving up seniority. Everyone knows you can get more money in the freight industry, but it's what we would call blood money, Kamenkov said. It's almost impossible to predict when you are going to be off and when you can attend to various life issues like family, like children, like an appointment. Contract talks continued Wednesday, with Labor Secretary Marty Walsh participating again to put pressure on both sides to reach a deal before Friday's deadline. And the third story on the front page is titled Meet Rosa, R-O-S-A. This is by Kelby Wingert. A new piece of technology at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center aims to give patients receiving hip and knee replacements better outcomes. On Wednesday, the hospital introduced the new robotic surgical assistant that will be used by the hospital's orthopedic surgeons for hip and knee replacement surgery. That's why it's called ROSA. Growing the orthopedics clinic at Trinity Regional has been a priority of Leah Glasgow, CEO and president of Unity Point Health, Fort Dodge, for several years, she said. In 2019, the hospital entered a new partnership with the Center for Neurosciences, Orthopedics, and Spine, PC, also known as CNOS, to bring orthopedic care back to Fort Dodge. It has been really a blessing to our community and the people we take care of right here at home, she said. The orthopedic surgery staff have used the ROSA in about 5 surgeries over the last 3 weeks, according to surgeon Dr. Prasnath Anand. During surgery, Anand, or fellow orthopedic surgeon Dr. Elijah Miller, placed probes into the joint undergoing operation, and those probes collect data both before and during surgery to help the surgeons use precision accuracy to tailor the joint implant to the patient's unique anatomy. It helps the surgeon in deciding some of the factors intraoperatively, Anand said. It assists us in some of the complex procedures so we can get a well-aligned, along with a well-balanced joint. For patients, a well-aligned joint will extend the life of the joint, he said. Joints implanted with standard surgical procedures have a 10 to 15-year lifespan, and by using the ROSA for precision, surgeons can extend that to 20 or more years. He said that the well-balanced joints also feel more natural to patients and improve patient satisfaction. We're really proud of our orthopedic team, the work that they're doing, and the advancement in technology that we have available right here at Unity Point Health Fort Dodge with our partnership with CNOS, Glasgow said. The device cost around $800,000, a well-placed investment, Glasgow said. This kind of advancement of technology does cost quite a bit of money, she said, but it's important for us to be able to provide excellence in orthopedics here in our community so that people don't have to travel. You can get everything you need right here. Recently, Trinity Regional Medical Center was recognized as the first hospital in Iowa to receive the DNV Hip and Knee Replacement Program certification, which validates the hospital's excellence across the spectrum of hip and knee replacement care, from diagnosis to treatment, rehabilitation, education, and outcomes. A lot of exciting things have been happening here in orthopedics, Anand said. We are excited and look forward to delivering advanced joint replacement surgeries here and at the same time making sure we meet a high standard of care. Accompanying the story is a photograph of ROSA. It has 2 parts, both of them with big screens on them. And Dr. Prasnath Anand is pictured in front of them explaining what they do. Let's take a minute to read the This Date in History column. Today is Thursday, September 15th, the 258th day of 2022. There are 107 days left in the year. Today's highlight: on September 15th of 1963, 4 black girls were killed when a bomb went off during Sunday services at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. 3 Ku Klux Klansmen were eventually convicted for their roles in the blast. On this date in 1776, British forces occupied New York City during the American Revolution. On this date in 1935, the Nuremberg Laws deprived German Jews of their citizenship. In 1940, on this date, during the World War II Battle of Britain, the tide turned as the Royal Air Force inflicted heavy losses upon the Luftwaffe. In 1972, a federal grand jury in Washington indicted seven men in connection with the Watergate break-in. On this date in 1981, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted unanimously to approve the Supreme Court nomination of Sandra Day O'Connor. 10 years ago on this date, 4 days after the deadly attack on a U.S. diplomatic outpost in Benghazi, Libya, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula called for more attacks on U.S. embassies. 5 years ago, the Cleveland Indians saw their winning streak end at 22 games, an American League record, as they lost 4-3 to the Kansas City Royals. And 1 year ago today, the 15th of September, SpaceX's first private flight streaked into orbit for a 3-day trip carrying two contest winners, a healthcare worker, and their rich sponsor. Today in history. In regional news, disabled voters win in Wisconsin, legal fights elsewhere. This is from the Associated Press in Madison, Wisconsin. Trudy LeBeau has voted in every major election since she turned 18, a half century of civic participation that has gotten increasingly difficult as her multiple sclerosis progressed. Now, with no use of her arms or legs, the Wisconsin woman relies on her husband to help her fill out and return a ballot. This year, it seemed for the first time that the 68-year-old would have to choose between her physical health and voting. After the Wisconsin Supreme Court outlawed ballot drop boxes in July, the state's top election official cited a state law that said voters had to place their own absentee ballots in the mail or return them to clerks in person. I certainly don't want to send my husband to jail because he put my ballot in the mailbox, LeBeau said. I would have to find some way of putting my ballot in my teeth and carrying it to the clerk's office. Fortunately for LeBeau, she and other Wisconsin voters with disabilities can get the help they need to return their ballots this November, after a federal judge last month ruled that the Voting Rights Act, which allows for voter assistance, trumps state law. In other states, however, battles continue over ballot assistance and other voting laws that harm voters with disabilities. As voters push back, challenges have arisen in the past 2 years to laws and practices in at least 8 states that make it difficult or impossible for people with certain disabilities to vote. Next, a story from the Associated Press in Detroit. Car guy Biden touts electric vehicles at Detroit Auto Show. President Joe Biden, a car guy with his own vintage Corvette, showcased his administration's efforts to promote electric vehicles during a visit Wednesday to the Detroit Auto Show. Biden traveled to the massive North American International Auto Show to plug the huge new climate tax and health care bill law that offers tax incentives for buying electric vehicles. He toured a mix of American-manufactured hybrid, electric, and combustion vehicles from Chevrolet, General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis on a closed-off convention center floor and greeted union workers, CEOs, and local leaders. "You all know I'm a car guy," Biden told a roaring crowd of auto workers, adding that cars just give me a sense of optimism, although I like the speed, too. While Biden has been taking credit for the recent boom in electric vehicle battery and assembly plant announcements, most were in the works long before the Inflation Reduction Act was signed into law on August 16th. Biden's 2021 infrastructure legislation could have something to do with it. It provides $5 billion over 5 years to help states create a network of EV charging stations. In Detroit, Biden announced approval of the first $900 million in infrastructure money to build EV chargers across 53,000 miles of the national highway system in 34 states and Puerto Rico. The Great American Road Trip is going to be fully electrified, Biden said. He also highlighted the law's funding supporting infrastructure projects in Detroit and across Michigan. When you see these big projects in your hometowns, Biden said, I want you to feel the way I feel. Pride. Pride in what we can do when we do it together. The president credited the United Auto Workers and other unions with supporting him in his 2020 bid for the White House. He highlighted how his administration has worked to promote union contracts for big projects, calling union workers the most skilled in the nation. The middle class built America, and unions built the middle class, Biden said. He made time for party politics, too. He praised Michigan Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who is up for re-election in November, calling her a great governor who has utilized federal resources for her state to the fullest. Biden also participated in a Michigan Democratic Party fundraiser on behalf of her re-election campaign. Another story from the Associated Press from Washington. United States sets up Afghan relief fund with frozen central bank money. A year after the tumultuous U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Biden administration said Wednesday it will transfer $3.5 billion in frozen Afghan central bank funds to benefit the Afghan people, as hunger grips every province there. Funds will be dispersed after trustees of the new Afghan fund meet to determine a timetable. The trustees are two Afghan economists, a U.S. government representative, and a Swiss government representative. Notably, the Taliban government will not have access to the fund, which will be held at the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. The bank, in a news release, said its role is limited to providing banking services to and executing the instructions of the Board of Trustees of the fund, without involvement in the fund's governance or decision-making. In the interim, Afghanistan's central bank, which in February had $7 billion in frozen funds, must demonstrate that it has the expertise, capacity, and independence to responsibly perform the duties of a central bank, the U.S. Treasury and State Department said in a joint statement. Robust safeguards have been put in place to prevent the funds from being used for illicit activity. International funding to Afghanistan was suspended, and billions of dollars of the country's assets abroad, mostly in the United States, were frozen after the Taliban took control of the country in August of 2021, following the U.S. military's withdrawal. The World Bank says income and economic output in Afghanistan have dropped between 20 and 30%. Imports have declined by roughly 40%. And 70% of Afghan households report they are unable to fully meet basic food or non-food needs. In February, President Joe Biden issued an executive order that called for banks to provide $3.5 billion of the frozen money to a trust fund for distribution through humanitarian groups for Afghan relief and basic needs. The other $3.5 billion will stay in the U.S. to finance payments from lawsuits by U.S. victims of terrorism that are still working their way through the courts, prompted by claims brought by family members of people killed on September 11, 2001. The Afghan Fund will help mitigate the economic challenges facing Afghanistan, while protecting and preserving $3.5 billion in reserves from Afghanistan Bank, Afghanistan's central bank, for the benefit of the people of Afghanistan, Treasury Deputy Secretary Wally Adeyemo said. He said the Taliban's repression and economic mismanagement had exacerbated long-standing economic challenges for Afghanistan that had made the return of the funds untenable. We'll turn to four brief news articles. The first, abortion ban legislation adds to political challenge for the GOP. This is from the Associated Press in Concord, New Hampshire. Don Bolduc didn't have much time to celebrate winning the Republican nomination for Senate in New Hampshire on Wednesday before he and other swing state GOP candidates were on the defensive. A conservative retired Army Brigadier General, Bolduc, insisted during the Republican primary he would, quote, always default for a system that protects lives from beginning to end, end quote. But South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham's decision to introduce legislation this week that would create a national abortion ban created the prospect that a campaign talking point could become a reality. With his attention now shifting to the November general election in a moderate state that President Joe Biden carried by more than 7 percentage points, Bolduc quickly distanced himself from Graham's measure. It doesn't make sense, he told Fox News, adding that abortion laws are better left to each individual state. Women on both sides of the issue will get a better voice at the state level. Next is from the Associated Press in Chicago. R. Kelly convicted of child porn and enticing girls for sex. A federal jury in Chicago convicted R. Kelly on Wednesday of producing child pornography and enticing girls for sex after a month-long trial in his hometown, delivering another legal blow to the Grammy Award winner who was once one of the world's biggest R&B stars. Prosecutors won convictions on 6 of the 13 counts against him, with many of the convictions carrying long mandatory sentences. But the government lost the marquee count that Kelly and his then-business manager successfully rigged his state child pornography trial in 2008. Both of his co-defendants, including longtime business manager Darrell McDavid, who had told jurors that testimony from 4 Kelly accusers had led him to change his mind about Kelly's believability, were acquitted of all charges. The trial was, in ways, a do-over of Kelly's 2008 child pornography trial, with a key video critical to both. Kelly, who shed tears of joy when jurors acquitted him in 2008, gave a thumbs-up sign to spectators after Wednesday's verdict, but otherwise showed little emotion. Before Kelly was returned to federal lockup, McDavid hugged Kelly, who rose from poverty on Chicago's South Side, to become a superstar. Then from the Associated Press in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, defense suddenly rests case in Florida school shooter trial. Attorneys for Florida school shooter Nicholas Cruz suddenly and surprisingly rested their case Wednesday after calling only a fraction of their expected witnesses, leading to a shouting match after the judge accused them of a lack of professionalism. Cruz's attorneys had told the judge and prosecutors they would be calling 80 witnesses, but rested at the beginning of Wednesday's court session after calling only about 25. There were 11 days of defense testimony overall, the last two spotlighting experts about how his birth mother's heavy use of alcohol during pregnancy might have affected his brain's development and led to his murder of 17 people at Parkland's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School 4 years ago. The sudden announcement by lead attorney Melissa McNeil led to a heated exchange between her and Circuit Judge Elizabeth Scherer, who called the decision without warning to her or the prosecution, quote, the most uncalled for, unprofessional way to try a case, end quote. And this last short article from the AP in Izum, Ukraine. Ukrainian flag raised in retaken city after Russian retreat. Hand on heart, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky watched his country's flag rise Wednesday above the recaptured city of Izum, making a rare foray outside the capital that highlights Moscow's embarrassing retreat from a Ukrainian counteroffensive. Russian forces left the war-scarred city last week as Kyiv's soldiers pressed a stunning advance that has reclaimed large swaths of territory in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region. As Zelensky looked on and sang the national anthem, the Ukrainian flag was raised in front of the burned-out city hall. After almost 6 months under Russian occupation, Izium was left largely devastated, with apartment buildings blackened by fire and pockmarked by artillery strikes. A gaping hole and piles of rubble stood where one building had collapsed. "The view is very shocking, but it is not shocking for me," Zelensky told journalists, because we began to see the same pictures from Bucha, from the first deoccupied territories, the same destroyed buildings and killed people. You are listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Next, we'll turn to today's obituaries. Turning to obituaries, the first one is for Shirley McMahon. Shirley McMahon, age 86, of Fort Dodge, passed away Tuesday, September 13, 2022, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 19th, at Holy Trinity Church. Burial will follow at Corpus Christi Cemetery. A visitation will be on Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m., with vigil prayer service at 5 p.m., all at Laufersweiler's funeral home. Shirley is survived by her children, Debbie Richardson, Cheryl McMahon, both of Fort Dodge, Sandy Mercer of Fort Dodge, Joe, spouse Tammy McMahon, Cindy McMahon, Kay McMahon, all of Fort Dodge. Additional family members, David, spouse Becky Coughlin of Smithville, Missouri, Courtney Coughlin of Granbury, Texas, 10 grandchildren, 20 great-grandchildren, 1 great-great-grandchild, siblings Betty, spouse Robert Condon of Clare, Bev, spouse Terry Axness of Badger, Mary, spouse Kelly Coughlin of Fort Dodge, Davy, spouse Connie Coughlin of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and sister-in-law Deb Coughlin. She was preceded in death by her parents David and Helen Coughlin, husband Joe in 2018. Siblings Terry Coughlin, Mike Coughlin, and Maureen, spouse Richard Shannon. Shirley Ann Coughlin was born July 29, 1936, in Fort Dodge. She attended schools in Barnum. On July 20, 1955, she was united in marriage to Joe McMahon, and the couple made Fort Dodge their home. Besides raising her children, she worked for Santa Fe and helped with the family farm. She also helped with the family businesses, including Eiler's Hotel, Budget Host Inn, and the Cellar Restaurant. Shirley was active with her family and their activities. She had a love for nature and animals, especially horses and dogs. Shirley will be greatly missed by all, especially her dog, Cricket. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Next, Leslie R. or Les Miller. Leslie R. Les Miller, 82, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, September 10, 2022, at the Grandview Health Care Center in Dayton. Services will be 11 a.m. Monday, September 19th, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel, with Pastor John Elkin officiating. Interment will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation is from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Les is survived by his daughter Karen Miller of Fort Dodge, 4 grandchildren, Christy, spouse Tony Ward, Raymond Glover, Tricia, spouse Quincy McCaleb, and Emily, spouse Joe McBurney. and great-grandchildren, Tristan Hines, Blake Klinger, Jackson Hines, Annalise Ward, Brandon Ward, Amari McCaleb, Savan McCaleb, Kyler Friddle, and Landon McBurney, and Caden McBurney. He is preceded in death. I'm sorry, those were four. Yes, those were great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his wife, Connie, his daughters, John, his parents, John and Eleanor, two daughters, Stacy McLaughlin and Sherry Glover, and his siblings, Dolores Snyder, Billy Miller, John Miller, Richard Miller, Janice Miller, Charlene Kreese, and Roberta Van Dyke, and a great-granddaughter, Mattia McLaughlin. Les has eight living siblings, Elmer, spouse Gwen Miller, Kevin, spouse Corrine Miller, Robert Miller, Linda, spouse Glenn Williams, Donna Nash, Teresa, spouse Dan Spangler, Melissa Farhat, Gloria Palmer. Leslie R. Miller, the son of John and Eleanor Miller, was born December 10, 1939, in Des Moines. He lived in Des Moines and Davenport before moving to Fort Dodge in 1954. He attended Fort Dodge schools. On December 14, 1960, Les was united in marriage to Connie Bowman in Webster City, Iowa. He was employed with Clyde, Hyde, and Furr for 17 years, the city of Fort Dodge from 1973 to 84, and U.S. Filters from 1984 until his retirement. Les was active in Lighthouse Ministries, enjoyed bowling, playing his harmonica, eating at Jamar's, road trips, and woodworking. And there are three brief death notices. From Algona, Glenn W. Jones. Funeral service is 11 a.m. Saturday, September 17, 2022, at First Presbyterian Church in Algona. Visitation is 9:30 to 11 Saturday at the church. From Webster City, Sonia McBurney. Sonia Harms McBurney, age 45, of Webster City, died Monday, December 12, 2022, at Van Diest Medical Center. Memorial services will be held at 3 p.m. Saturday, September 17, 2022, at Foster Funeral and Cremation Center. A family burial will be held at Graceland Cemetery. Visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. prior to the service at the funeral home Saturday. And from Clarion, Brandon Zigring. Funeral services are 11:30 a.m. Saturday, September 17, 2022, at the Red Shed Event Center in Clarion. Visitation is 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday at the Red Shed. Turning to the opinion page in today's paper, the Messenger editorial is titled Iowa Central, Iowa State, Team Up on 3D Printing. Schools will lead the way on new building technology. Printers are found in basically every home and business nowadays. Every day they spew out reams of words and numbers on flat pieces of paper. Newer devices that also are called printers are not limited to an output on flat pieces of paper. That kind of printer can make things that have length, width, and height. The devices known as 3D printers are fairly new technology, but more and more uses are being found for them. They have been used to make parts for several years. People who like to build scale models of airplanes and other vehicles are often working with components that were made with 3D printers. Now, Iowa Central Community College and Iowa State University are working together on a project that will move 3D printing technology to a massive scale. At the heart of the two schools' collaboration is a 40-foot-wide printer that can potentially be used to build houses. The machine is being assembled at the East Campus of Iowa Central. The concept of using a printer to build a house is kind of mind-boggling. It is easy to imagine someone loading lumber and cement into one end of some huge machine and watching a house come out the other end. Obviously, it is not that simple, not yet, anyway. But if it ever does become that simple, Iowa State and Iowa Central will likely have played a big role in making it happen. Those schools are engaged in one of the first programs in the nation, which is focused on using and testing 3D printing technology for home construction. Iowa State is focused on the engineering aspects of the technology. Iowa Central is training the people who will operate the 3D printers that will be used in the construction industry. By getting involved in this project, the leadership of Iowa Central is once again positioning the school in the forefront of worker training programs. That is a good thing for our community and state. The editorial cartoon today shows a bedraggled Uncle Sam with the world on his shoulders, pressing him down almost to the ground. But another politician over to the right saying, "Good news, gas prices have dropped." Then this editorial by syndicated columnist Jonah Goldberg, titled, "Surprised by Ukraine's Recent Victories? You Shouldn't Be." "Nobody knows anything," William Goldman, the legendary screenwriter, said. "Not one person in the entire motion picture field knows for a certainty what's going to work. Every time out, it's a guess, and if you're lucky, an educated one." I'm starting to think the same thing is true of foreign policy. Culminating over the weekend, the Ukrainian military has achieved some remarkable victories over their Russian invaders in the northeast of Ukraine. The scope and speed of the victories seem to have surprised everyone, starting with the Russians, who abandoned vast amounts of material as they fled in panic, or as the Russians put it, regrouped. It's the most significant Ukrainian victory since they thwarted Russia's assault on Kyiv in March. Except for Russia and its fan club, everyone, the markets, politicians, and media alike, were pleasantly surprised by Ukraine's success. Surprise seems to be an overarching theme in foreign policy these days. After all, many of the same people were surprised by Vladimir Putin's invasion in the first place. They were shocked again by Ukraine's success in thwarting Putin's plan for a quick, surgical, decapitate-and-conquer special military operation. The White House, and probably the Kremlin too, was stunned when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky refused to regroup, reportedly telling American officials, "The fight is here. I need ammunition, not a ride." There have been other Ukraine-related surprises for both the Russians and the West. From Russia's willingness to use barbaric tactics in plain view to Germany's willingness to reverse decades of pacifism to aid the war effort. Few, especially Putin, thought that Sweden and Finland would join NATO almost immediately in response to the invasion. Various diplomats have been shocked to learn that sanctions and condemnations have had little of their intended effect on Russia. This is all against the backdrop of other surprises. Many Afghans and Americans alike were startled by Biden's sudden withdrawal from Afghanistan. Whether the Pentagon was blindsided by Biden's decision is debated, but the collapse of the Afghan army clearly took us all by surprise, as Defense Secretary Lloyd J. Austin III admitted. The Trump years were so full of surprises, it's difficult to catalog them all, in part because Trump relished being a bull in a china shop. The success of the Abraham Accords took the foreign policy establishment off guard. But Trump's coddling of dictators mystified our allies. Before that, the Obama administration didn't foresee how their Russian reset wouldn't work. Nor did they see Putin's seizure of Crimea coming until it was a near fait accompli. They also failed to understand the threat posed by ISIS. The Bush years involved one shock after another, starting with the September 11th attack 21 years ago Sunday. The weapons of mass destruction American intelligence agencies, as well as their counterparts in Britain, expected to find in Iraq never materialized. And the Bush administration was caught flat-footed by the Iraqi insurgency. Indeed, ever since the end of the Cold War, another big surprise, the world has refused to comply with the confident assurances of the experts. China's rise stems in part from the confident bipartisan bet by politicians and policymakers that inclusion in the global trading order would put China on the path to democratization. I still think that's possible, but it's worth noting that the experts now all agree it isn't. What's the lesson here? I don't think it's that experts are never right. No doubt all sorts of shocks to the system were avoided because the experts headed them off. Averted crises are a lot less visible than unaverted ones. But all of these surprises do suggest a little humility is in order. Tactics and strategy, even the right ones, can be thwarted by the law of unintended consequences. The most important lesson, however, is that principles, unlike strategies, don't change with events. Firm public commitment to principles is often the best way to prevent unpleasant surprises, because most surprises come from your adversary's suspicion that you lack the resolve to adhere to them. Al-Qaeda attacked us because they believed we wouldn't fight. Putin invaded Ukraine because he believed NATO lacked resolve and the Ukrainians weren't serious about their nationhood. Clear principles and credibility that we will act on them is the best deterrence and the author of all worthwhile strategy. That again from Jonah Goldberg, a syndicated columnist. Turning to the sports page, we'll start with the Messenger Time Out With article. It's a series written by Eric Pratt today about athlete Connor Carver of Fort Dodge, a team-first mentality. Connor Carver is on the verge of joining an elite statistical club of Fort Dodge quarterbacks. Forgive the Dodger senior if he only celebrates passing the 3,000-yard mark for his career if the team defeats Marshalltown this Friday night. Carver doesn't pay much attention to his personal numbers, even as he continues to climb the program's all-time charts. The Bemidji State University recruit needs just 32 yards to join Drake Miller, Randy Reiners, and Andrew Stover in Fort Dodge's small group of signal callers to clear the 3,000 hurdle. "I don't have set individual goals, really," said Carver, a third-team All-State selection in 2021. "I've been more worried about how we are performing as a team, and I think that's led things to sort of falling in place for me. As a whole, I want to do something that no other Fort Dodge football team has ever done. That starts with going 1-0 each week and continuing to improve every day. Statistics and records have never been a priority, even though it is honestly surreal considering I grew up watching guys like Drake Miller. But I could go out and throw for 4,000 yards, and it doesn't mean anything if we can't push through to that next level and attain what we've set out to accomplish." The 6'2", 194-pound co-captain has thrown for 626 yards and 8 touchdowns through the Dodgers' first 3 games, while also rushing for a team-best 240 yards and a score at nearly 10 yards per carry. Carver currently ranks 2nd in passing touchdowns, 2nd in completions, and 3rd in offensive yards for Class 4A, as Fort Dodge Senior High, which is 1-2 overall, gets ready to face the Bobcats, that are also 1-2, at home this week. "I've been lucky enough to surround myself with those older guys who led before me. I saw what it really takes and how much you have to invest in the game to really get what you want out of it," Carver said. But that's also helped me become a better leader. And I think right now, we have a great group of captains. It makes it a whole lot easier being able to step on the field every day with those guys. Carver chose Bemidji State, a Division II program in northern Minnesota, after carefully researching the school and its resources. At first, I had very little knowledge about the place, but the more I talked to people, it seemed like everyone I knew somehow had a tie to Bemidji, and every single person had something good to say about it, Carver said. It's a beautiful place. I love the drive up there, love the town, and it's an absolutely awesome location. Who wouldn't want to play 200 feet away from a lake? The coaching staff is a hardworking group that wants to win, and what's best for you, I've been on multiple visits there now, and each time it gets better. Carver has always appreciated his time as a Dodger and what it represents. Former Fort Dodge Senior High head coach Sam Mosier said, "We're not the biggest, we're not the fastest, and we're sure as hell not the best looking, but by God, we'll beat your butt any day of the week." I think that quote sums up what it means to be a Dodger pretty well. Toughness and grit are something built into us. That's what sets us apart from a lot of other places. With 6 regular season games left, including 4 at home, Carver is only focused on cementing the legacy of his class and teammates through commitment and perseverance. "I want to be remembered for going my hardest every play, no matter the situation, because I believe that's what sets great leaders apart, being able to back up what you're trying to get your team to do," Carver said. "Play with heart, have pride in wearing that Dodger jersey, and never back down from any challenge." There was a unique history-making moment in sports in St. Louis. This is from the Associated Press. History for Cardinals, Molina and Wainwright. Adam Wainwright and Yadier Molina made history with the first pitch of the game. Then the record-setting battery helped the St. Louis Cardinals extend their National League Central lead by beating the Milwaukee Brewers 4-1 on Wednesday night. Wainwright and Molina started together for the 325th time, the most ever by a pitcher-catcher duo in the majors. The duo eclipsed the regular season mark of 324, held by the Detroit Tigers pair of Mickey Lolich and Bill Freehan from 1963 to 1975. Wainwright and Molina received a standing ovation from the crowd at Busch Stadium as they walked from the bullpen to the dugout prior to the game. And that completes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, September 15th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. My name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman, and I've been glad to be your reader today. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.